Good morning and welcome, everyone. Today is August 16th, 2017. It is 9 a.m. This is the Josephine County Board of Commissioners convening for our weekly business session. Full board is here this morning. We've got an important agenda, but we'll start with the Pledge of Allegiance like we always do. Gentlemen and ladies, please rise and remove your hats. Thank you, sir. We'll get started. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. A good time to put your cell phones on silent or vibrate, and we're going to go through our agenda. We've got a couple administrative items that we'll review before taking action. We'll move on to item number two, which is requests and comments from citizens. You'll just be provided 3 minutes. State your name and general locale, not your specific address as necessary, and then we'll come back and take action on the administrative actions, and then we'll move into the consent calendar and other items on the agenda. So without further ado, we'll move on to administrative item number 1A, which is approval of intergovernmental agreement number 11076 between Josephine County and Oregon Department of Education, Youth Development Division. Mr. Goodwin is our Director of Juvenile Justice. However, he's unavailable here this morning or may come in just a few minutes. But our liaison from the board is Commissioner Lily Morgan, and she'll be leading us through this effort.
This agreement is with the Oregon Department of Education for Youth Development, and it's an ongoing, so long as the detention and shelter is open, we are required to provide education services to the youth that are in the facility so that they do not have any disruption of their education. So this is an agreement with the Oregon Department of Education to provide and implement prevention programs designed to divert at-use risk away from the system and getting them help. So they'll go through assessments and get help. It's two-part, in the detention and also in the community. So the idea is keep them in school, keep them away from at-risk activity so that we can get them through and not stay in the system. So this is an $83,776 pass-through cost to the county from the Oregon Department of Education.
Pass-through cost or pass-through revenue?
Revenue, I'm sorry. Not cost to the county, revenue to the county to provide the service.
Great. Okay. Anything else on that subject? Item number 1B is approval of Sheriff's Association Collective Bargaining Agreement. We have our esteemed J.J. Schofield, Human Resources Director, here to brief us on this element.
Good morning, Commissioners. At this time, I'll actually discuss both contracts.
That'd be great.
We have two contracts. One is with our Sheriff's Association, and then the other is with our Parole Probation Officers Union, which is FAPO. For the purposes of today, I'll kind of run through the highlights of the changes of the contract. Typically, these contracts are two-year contracts. However, both of them, we were able to bargain three-year contracts, which is a great cost savings to the county. It's a collective bargaining is an expensive process, and doing it every 3 years is far superior to every 2 years. The likelihood is the next contract with FAPO will go back to two. They have biennial funding, which is why it's 2 years. But it's a challenge to bargain with that union because the state doesn't set the funding until after the contract expires, so it's a bit of guesswork. So we made 3 years so that we'll know what the funding will be next time we bargain.
So both contracts are for 3 years?
Both of them are for 3 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's encouraging because I think next year recommending to the board that we look or at least consider the idea of a two-year budget proposal. And maybe we have a bi-year next year, but with the intent of the following year to follow the legislative cycle, given that we've got two levies of a five-year funding stream, it might make a lot of sense to be able to look at some longer-range planning for our budgets as opposed to year-to-year, which historically has been kind of triage in style, and we've got some stability here. So thank you very much, Mr. Schofield. I think that'll serve the county really well.
Sure. So with the Sheriff's Association, again, 3 years, there was a big issue as it relates to their general base salary versus what insurance we offered for the bargaining unit. And typically in the bargaining process, those are the two linchpins of your fiscal decision-making. You know, how much do you contribute to insurance versus how much do you contribute for the salary? And ultimately, the put in lower cost of living adjustments. So what is in this contract is for a cost of living adjustment in year one of 2%, and then year two and three of 1.5%. And then on top of that, there was a little bit of longevity pay for employees that have stuck with the department 10, 15, or 20 years. So the reason that's of note is the current inflationary rate across the country is 2.5%. So what they put in, and this was actually a recommendation from the bargaining unit, was to offer a cost of living adjustment a little lower, actually, than the current inflationary rate, because the insurance was very important to them. The other things of note, with the Sheriff's Association, there's some language that was put in to quantify field training officer duties. It's been current practice, but it was never in the contract. We put that in the contract. Those refer officers who train new officers. There's some updated language on how you quantify vacation scheduling and quantify seniority. That particular bargaining has very complex rules for how you quantify seniority, and we try to make it more accessible and simplify it. And then we also put some language in to allow us to go to a bi-weekly pay structure instead of a monthly pay structure. So those are kind of the highlights with the Sheriff's Association contract. With our probation officer's contract.
Can we have questions on that first, Mr. Schofield?
Absolutely.
There may not be
sure.
any of the board. Commissioner DeYoung?
Yeah, when did collective bargaining start with this association?
It started around January, February.
Okay, all right. Just want to get a timeline. How long have you been working at this?
So the contract was ratified about a month ago, but it usually takes 2 to 3 months to go through the collective bargaining process. It can go longer than that if we can't come to an agreement. Both of these particular unions are what's called strike prohibited unions. And what that means is that they're not legally allowed to go on strike. If there's an emergency, we need police officers, we need probation officers. The state says they're not legally allowed to strike. And so with in the state rules, what they have instead is if the management group and the union are not able to come to an agreement in the contract, then it goes up to the state, which is the Employee Relations Board, and you go through the arbitration process, and the state basically looks at both contracts and picks a winner. And that process is basically a court hearing, and it's very expensive. It's usually $30,000 to $40,000 to go through that process. And neither side wants to do it. It's very time-consuming and very expensive on both sides.
It also doesn't serve the best interest sometimes of the county, because if we lose one element of our proposed agreement, we lose all of our elements, and we cover their legal costs for the process. So it's kind of that balance of, okay, so you're not able to strike, but if you ever do go to the Employee Review Board, the rules are a little bit bent in their favor. I say a little bit, but we don't like to go there.
Yeah, it's a three-member panel who makes big decisions. And when it comes to this particular process, they actually appoint an arbitrator, and that person would look at the contract and, you know, pick a winner. Some states, they'll pick and choose from the contract, but in Oregon, it's all this contract or all this contract. And the city just went through that process with their representative group and to their detriment, frankly. Ultimately, neither side wants to go to do that process. It's no fun on either side, and both parties are very amenable. And we work together to try to have a collaborative process. So that's why I think we have a successful contract now.
Anything, Commissioner Moore?
Well, we asked a lot of questions the other day, which I actually thought we did pretty well with this one. It is where it is. So
that's a good point. I think in this process, having started back in January, this is the first contract. We have four unions at the county. These are the first union negotiations that this board has been a part of. However, in the past, we've had COLAs that are based at the discretion, in most union negotiations, at the discretion of the board between 0 and 4%. We usually, with that element of discretion at the board level, we give up certain medical benefits usually. There's a balancing act to all of these kinds of conversations. So with this proposed contract of having done away with the range, identified a COLA you can agree upon every year at 1.5%, if I heard you right?
2% in the first year, 2%. 1.5%, 1.5%.
One of the elements that I think is important to look at that is the negotiating capability of the board or the recruitment ability of the county is impacted when our salary comparisons are not necessarily with our 8 or 9 other comparable counties. And we sometimes suffer in that regard because we've probably been as effective as we have in the past at negotiating these agreements. At some point, you get to being negatively impacted by your recruiting ability if you're too frugal with salaries. It can come around to sometimes you don't always get the best applicants, you don't get that many, and your ability to retain employees is not as stellar as other municipalities. So I think we've kind of struck a balance there with kind of slowly working our way to a competitive element in our comparators. So thanks, Mr. Schofield. If there's nothing else, I think we'll move on to item number C, that union contract, which is the approval of collective bargaining agreement between Josephine County and the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers, known as FOPO. So Mr. Schofield.
So with this one, there are fewer changes. Primarily, the issue with this bargaining group is their salaries. So there's less, I guess, day-to-day structural issues with the contract. So this also is a 3-year contract, and I believe this is the first time we've had a 3-year contract since the inception of this particular bargaining unit. So of concern with this unit was, in doing a comp analysis, they were about 6 or 7% behind their comparables. And as such, they wanted to pull up higher than the inflationary rate. So the inflationary rate is 2.5%. So we came to an agreement of 2.9%, which is 0.4% above inflation. So that would get them closer to their comparables, but it isn't, you know, significantly higher than the inflationary rate. So it's a 3-year contract with the same cost of living adjustment for all 3 years. The other changes within the contract are we're maintaining the insurance package for this bargaining unit. So the county offers two different types of insurance. The majority of the county is with the Oregon Educators Benefit Board, and our primary insurance carrier is Modena. And the reason we like that is OEP has went through an RFP process this last year, and as part of that, MoDA has given us some guarantees on increases in our insurance premiums. So having the knowledge that we know what those are going to be is very valuable to the county because a potential liability is known. That was the challenge with the Sheriff's Association. Their insurance doesn't have set rate guarantees, and so with the unknowns in the healthcare market, that was a challenge for us. So that is, you know, you look at 2.9, a big number, but you have the guarantee of increases in insurance, which is helpful. The other changes in the contract, if there's some language to allow the 2-week pay cycle, there's some language clarifying the definition of probationary employees. There's been concerns over the years on how do you quantify probationary status of an existing county employee in this bargaining unit. So that clarifies that. And then also it clarifies some issues on field training officers and firearm instructor pay. We wanted to quantify that basically we didn't want employees to be able to double dip in the different methodologies with which you can be a firearms instructor.
Anything?
So that's 2.9 a year?
Yes.
And will there be any cost to the county in this, or with the, I know the revenues from the state just came through as far as what their portion is. Is this covered by that?
So this is a state-funded department, so it will have zero general fund effect on it.
One of the elements that's really important, I think, when we're doing the negotiations either for individual recruitments or in this collective bargaining is that we're within 5% of our comparators. And so if we're out on an average, trying to make an effort to bring that back in, it also might influence how we negotiate in that third year moving forward. If the inflationary rate, setting that ahead of time without some discretion in years 2 or 3 is a little bit of a concern to me because of where it could go. At the end of the day, you said it, that this doesn't have an impact on the general fund. And frankly, if their program finds themselves in a situation where they're fiscally strapped to be able to accommodate that 2.9%, It's the staffing element overall that's going to ultimately suffer. That's their biggest cost, is staff in community corrections probation departments. So I think that's got to be their consideration as well, or at least management's understanding that if that's agreed upon, it can have a double-edged sword component to it. I think you've mentioned the bi-monthly pay. I don't know that we've talked about that a lot. It's something that the county and the board has wanted to go towards. It doesn't mean that anybody gets paid anymore. It actually is a reduction in the administrative overhead, because we have two structures right now for salaries being paid out. We have about 160 people on a monthly basis doing mid-month draws, which we allow here at the county. But it's an administrative burden to be administering both programs instead of just having one. And so moving to that in the early part of September, to where the entire county is going to have bi-monthly pay, I think is going to provide an administrative reduction burden over there to our finance and payroll office, just instituting one and not having to try to do both. I think that's going to be positive. And the unions have all signed on to approval of that, heard their concerns, and we've mitigated those challenges. So if there's nothing else, I think we're... Could go on to item number two, which is questions and comments from citizens. Again, you'll just have 3 minutes to speak on any subject you like. It's just appropriate to provide your general locale of residency, not your specific address, your name, and speak clearly. And just raise your hand. We'll get through everybody. Ms. Casanelli.
Really unthinkable, you know, to burden people who have to come, like the 30K Junction, pop in an hour drive, and then look at a document and then drive all over that. Especially with the ease of the document in this electronic age. So those are my requests for today. Any comments or questions?
I didn't catch what the last document said wasn't available except in our office.
Findings of fact.
Thank you.
For the McMahon.
Yep.
Yeah. Thank you.
I do have one comment, Ms. Castanelli. If there's any way we could maybe hear those administrative concerns about the highlighted and the redline version, we're happy to try to accommodate those things, but I think it's really hard for us to do that, you know, on a Wednesday morning. And so when we usually have these administrative discussions on Thursday, which leads to the presentation of the weekly business session agenda in final form, usually Friday afternoon, if you wouldn't mind either contacting the office, sometimes they could be busy, you can contact me with an email, and I'll do my best to try to get that clarified as to either why we didn't, or yes, let's just change it up and fix that. So happy to try to make those accommodations. Thank you, Ms. Castanelli. Anyone else for comments to the board here this morning? Come forward.
Yes, my name is Gerald Jackson. I'm from Williams.
Good morning, Mr. Jackson.
I'd like to withhold comments until possibly point number four, or I might have a little bit more time. I'm not sure I could fit 3 minutes worth of discussion right now.
Yeah, that's kind of not how we do the agenda, and we keep it pretty consistent because it has a tendency to expand over time if people... There's varying passions on different agenda items. We're going to restart your time because I think you've asked for an administrative element. Unfortunately, we can't really change the agenda. You're asking specifically about the last item. That's one you're probably going to need to speak with either Ms. Schmelzer or myself afterwards as the liaison in the community development. Is that what you're looking to find as a fact?
Oh, no, excuse me. Maybe I was talking about point number four, where it was time for other comments.
Oh, that's for the board.
I see.
The board has the ability to make comments on any subjects, even if they're not listed on the agenda.
Okay.
That's specifically for taking action on an item that wasn't made aware of the board. So that's more of our stuff rather than yours.
Okay, so
when we restart your time, do you mind if
minutes.
You... Yeah, you've got 3 minutes. I'm sorry, Mr. Jackson.
Okay.
Go ahead.
The reason I'm here is in regard to the Williams overlay process they're pursuing. We've had to go to our own personal expense to put information out there. We're putting signs out that say no overlay. And this is kind of a directive I've gotten from landowners that own the properties that might be affected by this overlay process. We're talking about EFD lands, woodland resource, those type of landowners feel like they're disenfranchised from this process. They don't feel like they've been able to even understand what an overlay is. I've had several old folks come to me and say, why are you opposed to a paving project? They thought an overlay was paving. It just shows a general lack of information out there. The CAC is saying they don't have the ability, time, or budget to be able to get the information out there in a public opinion poll or anything like this. They're pursuing an election process of the overlay, and Lily admonished them that they had not done the proper paperwork to be able to have an election, first of all. But before that, I believe the information needs to get out to the entire community, and what we're seeing is that is not happening. And they're going to elect in a new CAC council to help institute this overlay process, and those folks are going to be responsible for making rule changes that will affect the very properties that I was talking about. And I was hearing from those folks after the last town meeting that if the folks that own those lands don't come to the meeting, too bad. They said, too bad if they don't show up. That's their responsibility to come. Folks don't know about the meetings. They don't even know who the CAC is. They're not doing their homework. And I believe that this process is going to roll back on the county ultimately because they're going to make land use be doing this. There was a sign that went up. It said, trust the commissioners. I didn't put that one up, but it said, trust the commissioners. That was vandalized last night. It's taken down. The CAC is telling in the last meeting that the commissioners don't have the knowledge or the ability to make this decision. They said that. The commissioners are not doing their job. And what I'm asking you to do is, it is your job to maybe control these folks and tell them to slow down a little bit on this overlay process and to do a little bit more of a democratic process. Thank you.
Thanks. Anyone else? Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the board. Only two items. I think as the liaison to the Community Development Department, I'll speak a little bit on your points, Mr. Jackson, on the Williams CAC and their desire for a Williams overlay to try to advise the board about specific regulations that might improve the overall use of the land through zoning in Williams. The board has not taken a formal position one way or the other on the overlay. In fact, we've not taken a formal position on the Williams CAC. That is not a board or a county function as far as appointment, authority, oversight, regulation. And so controlling these folks is the quote that I got from. It's really hard to control staff or things, people that work for us, let alone people who don't. That's my point. It's really the CAC looking to do this overlay, whether the board ultimately endorses the creation of that or not, would be an action of the county. But it would be advisory in capacity. There's no state statute that provides for a CAC to have the authority to regulate land use. And frankly, there's more state statute that governs a rural planning commission's authority to make land use decisions and recommendations to the board. More than an CAC. So really, it's another, in my opinion, it's another layer before you actually get to the Board of Commissioners. I am the first to agree that there are shortcomings of the county as far as to address marijuana regulation and that sort of industry that's frankly just been thrust upon the county. I just got back from a conference up on the coast, and you drive through the rest of the state, and they don't have these grows on every corner. 17 between my parents' place and Cave Junction that we can see from the road. There's got to be a lot more. I didn't see 17 in driving over an hour and a half through Douglas County or Lane County. I saw like one or two from the freeway. So it's really a very Josephine County-focused issue, and we haven't had a lot of tools to help us with this from the state's perspective. They've always been telling us, oh, we'll fix that. We hear you. We're working on it through the 91 Implementation Task Force and Carl Wilson's representation on there. Good efforts by his office. We're been kind of in that wait mode. We've asked that non-binding question. We are going to lean into this issue this fall and have through our community development director and her initiatives to try to refine local land use laws. So I can appreciate people's patience being tried. But we are going to be working on that very diligently in the very near future, so you could see things. Some of the things that I've heard that the Williams CAC is looking to try to regulate as far as agricultural production and use, it's really pretty well protected under the Oregon Right to Farm and Forest Act. And we're not going to put ourselves in the crosshairs of time-tested and true pieces of legislation. That is the bedrock of land use, frankly, in the state of Oregon. And I think it's served maybe not all of everyone's objectives, but it served the state pretty well. And I don't expect that to be really challenged by this Board of Commissioners. At least it wouldn't be a wise direction. I think we are going to take this slowly and diligently, and I'm interested to see how that poll comes back. But an unscientific outside of a local election, that's going to have a grain of salt with it in forming my opinion on whether or not we actually do create a Williams CAC. So I think the board is going to take its time, be diligent about that, certainly seek out the expertise of the staff that we have, before that. It isn't a done deal, I'd say, that creation. So your points are well taken, well heard. And
thank you.
Is there anything else that the board wants to?
I did meet with concerned citizens group on Friday night, and 36 folks showed up on a Friday evening, which I thought was actually an impressive turnout. And spent some time in Williams throughout the evening afterwards as well, and kind of seeing what some of the concerns were with some of the farms. But what information I had received, as I said, I think there's some differences in language going on when they say an election of an area. That means something different to me as far as an election through the county's clerk's office where ballots are sent to registered voters versus what the bylaws of the CAC say is an election for their board members. And so there, we are seeking clarification on that, and we'll get legal is checking on the exact language to give an opinion on what that situation is. But the reality is something that affects the entire area. To me, it is important that there be an election that goes through the clerk's office where registered voters have an opportunity to weigh in on that if it's a district that's different that affects an area. But that's my opinion. That's not representative of the board. But it was good to hear just the perspective of everybody out in Williams and to hear their concerns, as far as the safety of their community and what has changed with having so many people come in from outside of the area for employment. And the goal and the hope would be that as folks come in, that they're taking part in the community and taking care and pride in the community. And so trying to find, again, all these issues that are coming up with marijuana seem to me to be good neighbor issues. So it's not that it's the industry, it's that it's how do we, when we're close proximity to other people and living near other people, how do we be good neighbors and find a way to work through those issues? So anyhow, and I did want to, as far as the administrative stuff that Ms. Castanelli mentioned, we did have a red line version that we looked at on Thursday at our admin meeting, so I'm not sure as far as if we just need to internally make some decisions on what gets posted on that. But we did have that. We did see the red line version. And that was something we poured over on Thursday's admin meeting last week before bringing it this week.
JJ, would you mind coming to the podium? I have a couple of questions. I'm not always going to do this, but a constituent has sent me a couple of text messages. Thank you, Mr.
Sure.
Jackson.
Thanks.
Can you go over a couple of these things that I think will be beneficial to everybody? So what are our comparator counties, if you wouldn't mind running
sure.
through those six or seven?
We have to think of them all.
They're defined by state statute based on population.
Yeah, so
that is the comparator of element. And so
yeah,
Jackson County at 200,000+ is not a comparator.
No. So the...
you don't have to tell us them all. But
yeah, so the Public Employee Relations, Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act, as a state law that specifies how you do collective bargaining in Oregon. And in that law, it spells out how you define comparability. And in that, they say you base it on population. So you want to have a entity that is similar. And what I define similar is it's a county entity. I'm not looking at cities. And it's a county of similar population. So our comparators are Coos, Benton, Yamhill, Lincoln, Umatilla, what all the other ones are, Polk, that's six, there's a couple more.
Did you say Klamath?
Klamath, and Douglas.
Douglas. Yeah.
I think that's all of them.
Except with community corrections. Douglas is not an acceptable comparator.
For FAPO, we don't use Douglas, and Lynn is the other one. For FAPO, we don't use Lynn and Douglas because those agencies are run by the state, and so they're not comparable entities. They do their comparable analysis of other states. So we don't include those two counties in our analysis for our comparators of the parole probation officers.
Did these negotiations with unions ever happen in public? Why or why not?
Typically they don't, and the reason being is sometimes they can be contentious. They have the ability to be made public if both parties agree to it, and sometimes they do, but typically they don't because they want to have the ability to be frank and honest within the back and forth communication, and if it is made public, sometimes the ability to do that is hindered. It depends on the union. Some unions would prefer it to be public, others don't. And part of the collective bargaining process, the very first thing that we do is we agree to basically the rules of bargaining. And that's the first step anytime you go into bargaining. You say, this is what I'm willing to adhere. I won't do this, and I won't do this, and we're going to bargain in good faith. So typically, when we allow outside entities to be part of witnesses, we ask that they sign off that they also are willing to abide by those rules. However, if it is not either a member of management or a member of the bargaining unit, there's no legal way to hold them accountable if they choose not to follow the rules.
My last... Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I've got
it. It was along that line. When I sat on the city council and we went to bargaining union negotiations, councilors were allowed to sit in on just not as taken apart, but they were allowed to sit in. Is that the same case here?
It depends on the
ground rules.
The ground rules. I don't think any of the bargaining unions would have a problem with the members of the commissioners sitting in. I would have a real issue with a member of the board being actively engaged. And the reason
right.
I would is we come to, before we take it to the board, both parties sign what we call a tentative agreement. And basically we say, we agree that this is a contract we're both in agreement with. They take it to their membership, and their membership can vote it down and say, we're not willing to sign off on that. And then I take it to the board, and the board can then say, we're not willing to sign off on it. And if an individual commissioner signed the TA and said, yes, I agree to this, and then voted no later, that would be evidence of unfair labor practice, because you would be bargaining unfairly and not bargaining good faith. So I would have no problem at all with a commissioner witnessing the bargain. That has happened in the past. If it happened in the future, I wouldn't have a problem with it. I would advise against a commissioner being on the actual bargaining team.
I think I would advise against it, too, to be honest.
Yeah,
they have in the past, and there are some commissioners who say, well, no, I want to do that.
Not since I've been on the board, and I wouldn't endorse that idea either, just for the reason you can have, three steps forward in such an element and a minimum of five steps backwards.
It legally hinders your ability to do your job as a commissioner and vote objectively.
Yep.
Okay.
So. The last one has to do with the PERS element, which is seriously always the 800-pound gorilla in the room. The conference that I just got back from, the comparator of Oregon relative to other states in the nation, we have a 70%, 30% liability with our long-term PERS unfunded. The counties is significantly less than that. Our PERS liability is less than 12% overall of our employees, as far as I'm aware, and that's mostly bonded. And really, when I look at the PERS issue, it's a statewide issue. It's not a county by county or 147 municipalities in the state going to simply be able to make an incremental. It's kind of like us having an effect on climate change, and I don't want to pull that in as a political football, but Oregon is 0.1% of the world's carbon emissions of any good statistic. We're not going to make a difference in the PERS state overall unfunded liability in that. And we don't set policy on PERS. The legislature does. So it's something we've done a diligent job of including as part of our payroll liability. And it is growing over time. But we're looking to the state to really take leadership over that trajectory in the future of not incurring additional unfunded liability through PERS employees. Ideally, we'd like to see something where we could graduate off of the PERS and go to a self-determined 401k style, much like what the private sector does, and have it reflective of the market, as opposed to one of the big challenges is the tier one of a guaranteed 8% return every year. And the challenge is that if you don't get that in the market, the legislature or the taxpayer has to make up the difference. And that's the craziest contract anyone could have ever signed. It just seems silly, but it is what it is. We've inherited that. We were a reluctant or late comer to the PERS system, so we don't have the number of tier one employees or to the degree that other municipalities have. So actually, we've been doing a pretty good job of trying to mitigate that challenge as much as we can on our side over the last several decades. But is there anything else you'd say to that?
One important distinction for Josephine County and most counties in the state is PERS is structured where the entity makes a contribution first, and depending on whether you're in Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 4, officer, the way that is structured is different. But basically, the majority of the money that goes into PERS is contributed by the entity. And then there's a 6%, which is coined with the 6% match. And the reason it's called the 6% match is originally when PERS was constructed, it was designed that, you know, the entity put in 6%, the employee put in 6%. And the 6% the entity put in has grown over time. But most of all of the local governments in the entire state, and not even just local governments, public employees, they pay that for the employee. And that's why it's called a match. So they pay the 6% and they match that 6%. But Joshua County doesn't do that. The employee, if the employee makes, you know, $10,000, well, 6% of that is taken out of their pay and put into PERS. Where in other entities, it's not, the entity picks up that match. So the amount that affects our actual ability to manage our budget is mitigated because we have abided by the original structure of PERS and the employee pays that match. And there are a couple counties that are like us that do that, but it's pretty rare. And so our liability to PERS is less as a result.
I think that's a pretty good thumbnail sketch of where we are in that, so as it relates to item number 1B and C. So thank you very much, Mr. Schofield. Anything else for comments? All right, we'll go into action on the administrative calendar. Item number 1A is approval of intergovernmental agreement number 11076 between Josephine County and Oregon Department of Education Youth Development Division. Entertain a motion to approve item 1A.
So moved.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Any further discussion? Seeing none. All, please call the roll.
Commissioner DeYoung?
Yes.
Commissioner Morgan?
Yes.
Commissioner Hare?
Yes. Motion carries 3-0. Item number 1B is approval of Sheriff's Association collective bargaining agreement.
Make a motion we approve the Sheriff's collective bargaining agreement.
I'll second.
Moved and seconded to approve item number 1B. Any further discussion? Please call the roll.
Commissioner DeYoung?
Yes.
Commissioner Morgan?
Yes.
Commissioner Hare?
Yes. Motion carries. Item number 1C is approval of collective bargaining agreement between Josephine County and Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers, known as FAPO.
Make a motion we approve 1C, approval of collective bargaining agreement between Josephine County and Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers.
I'll second that.
I moved and seconded. Any further discussion? And both items 1B and C, I'd like to thank Mr. Schofield, his office, and the management teams in both of those for acting responsibly on behalf of the county to try to come to an agreement without having to go to collective bargaining or the employee review board. Please call the roll.
Commissioner DeYoung?
Yes.
Commissioner Morgan?
Yes.
Commissioner Hare?
Yes. Motion carries. Item number 3 is the consent calendar made up on item number A is various minutes of the Board of Commissioners. Bless you.
Sorry.
Also part of item number A. And number 3B is grant agreement with options for Southern Oregon Incorporated for management and administration of mental health services under state OHA. An intergovernmental agreement number 153126, dated 7/1/17 to 6/3/19. A 2-year agreement. And we have Ms. McCafferty from Options here to brief us on this item. We reviewed it last Thursday, I believe, and Commissioner Morgan is liaison to mental health services in Josephine County, but we have Ms. McCafferty here.
It's one Carl McCafferty, I'm the executive director for Options for Southern Oregon, and we are the community mental health program for Josephine County. This grant agreement is our biennial agreement for funds that flow to us from the state of Oregon. And from the Oregon Health Authority largely. So it's comprised of a number of different smaller grants that have targeted populations and targeted expectations for the manner in which the funding is spent. So I would say probably the minority of the money that comes through this grant is really for the community mental health program, the responsibilities that are in statute. And those things are 24/7 mobile, 24/7 response to the hospital for people who are in psychiatric crisis. And those services need to be delivered by trained master's level clinicians. Protective service investigations and services for people with mental illness, a subset of people with mental illness who are receiving certain services in our county. Pre-commitment investigations. So those are investigations by trained and certified master's level clinicians and reports to the court for people who may need to be placed on a civil commitment for a period of 6 months. So they gather that information, have interviews with families and others, and present their findings to the court for the court to make a determination around those things. So those are really the majority. Oh, and also, the coordination of and payment for hospitalization services for people with psychiatric illness who are indigent, so who are not insured. So those are really kind of the bulk of the responsibilities that fit within the community mental health program that are considered part of the social safety net for our county. And then the other funding that comes through those grants, through that intergovernmental agreement, are funds which our organization has largely applied for through various grants that were available at the state level, and we work with community partners on a lot of those projects. So they're shared projects such as our in-reach work that we do at the jail with the sheriff's office. So we have master's level clinicians, case managers, and peers who actually do in-reach in the jail. There's a whole process set up for us to assess people who are coming into the jail and who also may already be in the jail to determine if mental illness is a contributing factor to the reasons why they are there, and to get them out of jail as quickly as possible and into productive recovery services for them, and then we follow them along afterwards. That's one example. Another example is our mobile outreach team, which is a grant we apply for both with the mobile outreach team and the jail diversion team. Our projects that we apply for in conjunction with a lot of our community partners, so the sheriff's office, grants past public safety, the courts, the public defender's office, the district attorney's office, and we design these projects around those systems so that would allow us and those systems to interface more effectively, so that we're identifying those folks who have mental illness where they may be presenting to us, people who they think are suffering from mental illness, and we're intervening and getting them out of those systems and into the mental health system and helping them get into recovery and move along in their lives. So there's projects like that, the residential treatment programs that we have, both secure and non-secure for people who have mental illness, who serve our population in our county and also people, other people from across the state, because we really don't have the size to operate residential treatment programs just within this county. We kind of have to do it more on a statewide basis, and they're also set up as statewide resources, but it allows us to keep people who have severe mental illness here at home, close to their loved ones, to treat them, and then it enables us to do a better job at doing the discharge planning and getting them into supportive housing and supports and things like that. So a lot of those services make up the bulk of that intergovernmental agreement, but the Oregon Health Authority and the state like to utilize the contracting process between the state and another public entity because it's a more efficient process for them to do that. So in communities where there is a local mental health authority, which is the commissioners, and a community mental health program, they utilize the county as kind of that pass, as that pass-through entity for those grants that we apply for as an organization.
Any questions?
I have a couple comments. Yeah. So I, you know, the details in this agreement too put requirements on Options mm-hmm. as being the grantee,
right.
The recipient of this grant, to be doing reporting through the state MOT
mm-hmm.
system and holding insurance levels at different
right.
minimum levels.
Right.
And so even though the system has changed with the coordinated care organizations
mm-hmm.
and Options has contracts with them individually, there is still this portion that we still have a connection with. And I appreciate that we get to be a part of it. I know it might be hard to have other people looking so thoroughly at your organization, but just a couple weeks ago, the state was here doing their audit of your programs and such, and it was a very positive experience for going through that process and hearing the state's perspective and seeing how we interact. And what I have, I do believe Oregon has a long way to go with improvements in our mental health system. But with the limitations that we have in Oregon, I believe Options is doing an outstanding job with providing services in our community and really stepping above peers and other communities to show how we are able to provide these services. So you guys really are just doing an outstanding job with it. And I want to thank you for the level of care and compassion that your staff shows towards our community.
Well, I appreciate that. Well, and if I can just brag for one quick minute, yes, that is one of many, many, many reviews and audits that we receive because we hold a variety of licenses and do such a kind of large scope of work. And if I can brag for 1 minute, I think an example of that is we hold the state's two centers for excellence for both the certification and treatment, which is an outreach team, the interdisciplinary outreach team that goes out into the community and works with some of these folks who have very severe illness, and also supported employment, helping people get back to work. And we actually operate around the state systems for all the communities across the state in terms of helping them develop and implement evidence-based, fidelity-based programs to help people get back to work and to help keep people out of the hospital and getting them into treatment. And I think that's a kind of an example of that. I kind of like to talk about that because even though we have a large challenge with mental health and mental illness in our state, Josephine County really is fully integrated with MECN, one of the premier programs. And I appreciate the support of the commissioners for that. So
thank you. Ms. McCafferty, I think I'd like to say thank you as well. I was part of that review 3 years ago. When I was liaison to that, or that's my second, I think. Are you seeing an increase in the need for services provided by Options of Southern Oregon? It certainly is getting at least more attention, I think, in the mainstream, the need and the alternative to incarceration or hospitalization for people who are suffering from mental health challenges. It's really coming to the forefront, I think, in society as something we really need to focus and lean in on, and it's having a detrimental effect to the quality of life of the people who are suffering from these, and for those who experience when somebody isn't being taken care of properly.
I think what we're seeing is the cases, the folks that we're working with and the cases we're involved in have become, I think, much more complex over the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that is because of the drug use in our community. And so you start to get this chicken and the egg situation. Is it drug? Is it mental health issue? Which, did it start with this? Did it start with that? And trying to decipher that out. But also the answer is just drug use in our community is a challenge. And the things that come along with that, you know, domestic violence, people not finishing, children not finishing school, children, parents struggling to parent. So those are all areas that we've been trying to develop and have been developing extra services in to really try to get in there earlier with families. For example, we have master's level clinicians in every Head Start program in our county and every school, and I don't think you can say that for anywhere else in our state.
Wow.
And that's really trying to get in there and intervene early with families to help parents parent and help children be successful and stay in school and hopefully, you know, come out at the other end with jobs and colleges and careers and that kind of thing. So that's a lot of the challenges we're dealing with. So
it sounds like it's going to take a long time to steer the ship in a more positive direction.
It's just it's a constant.
Yeah, okay. Penny?
Do you see since the lottery became legal, did you have a gaming or gambling problem in the community before that, or just since the, you know, if I go out to dinner, I see people playing those machines just like clockwork, and the $100 bills just go in one right after another, and it surprises me.
Those kinds of things, I think, tend to exacerbate the situation that's already in existence. Anything that makes something that something that can be an addiction more readily available to people has a tendency to increase that. We provide addiction, or we provide gambling treatment, both crisis stabilization and outpatient. In fact, we're one of, I think, the two crisis stabilization programs in the state for people who have gambling, and we will take people from across the state for that. But gambling is one of those real hidden addictions. Oftentimes, families really are destroyed by the time somebody can kind of put their finger on what's happening and realize what's going on here. And so then those folks are in crisis by then, and then you kind of got a mental health issue as well. So I would say, I would have to look at what the statistics are for that, but it's been our experience, I think, in anybody who works in the addictions field, that the more readily available things are to people, the more people participate. And youth and gambling is a big deal as well. So high school, a lot of work in high schools and other schools do try to do prevention work around this. So.
Thank you.
We could probably discuss the subjects that you represent ad nauseum and probably need to. Anything we can do at the county to probably help these efforts, and more than just a facilitator through this IGA, occasional reviewer, we're happy to be a participant. I know we have a number of different programs that we help administer through our public health, and we're just recently looking at consolidating our prevention program. I think we're trying to make streamlined methods so that people are less separately siloed, and figure out ways that we can really tackle these issues.
Well, I would like to say at the service level, we work very closely with those departments,
mm-hmm.
with the addictions, with public health, corrections, probation, parole, share. So at the service level, we're very well integrated in the courts and such.
Yeah.
And it's probably something we could, we can talk a bit more about. So.
Okay, great. Thank you, Ms. McCafferty.
Thank you.
Item number 3C is contract for personal services with Parametrics, amendment number 4. This is through Public Works, and Commissioner Dan DeYoung is the liaison.
Yeah, this is an amendment to extend the original personal services contract with Parametrics, dated back in 2009, for the monitoring of the Kirby and Marlson landfills for the DEQ closure requirement. And this is just an ongoing thing. Every year we have test wells at both sites, and kind of gives us an idea what next to do. Parametrics has been our consultant all along. So this is just to extend the original personal service contract. It's $177,000 for the contract amendment number 4 for a total of $646,686 since 2009. Funding is from the Public Works of Solid Waste Fund.
Pretty comprehensive. It goes through 2020, July. So nothing else to add. We'll move on to item number 3D, findings of fact and decision in the matter of an appeal of the Rural Planning Commission's decision on the McMahon subdivision. Appellant Shannon McMahon, owner Shannon and A. McMahon Trust, legal descriptions 37-05-26, tax lot 300. And we have Ms. Schmelzer here, Community Development Director, to present on this.
So last week when we reviewed the findings of fact, the board had a concern with item 5.4. It basically had read that there was a misrepresentation with the code. So we cleaned that up by just removing the very first sentence to make it so there was no question on that. And it basically says that, the applicant was able to show that they had complied with the code, and therefore the driveway spacing was going to be approved. So other than that, there was one typo that we found, but nothing else has changed since you looked at it last week, other than 5.4.
There's item number 5.5, which is the refund element, and I think you guys have reached a reasonable agreement on that. The board will, in the future, if a appeal fees are to be refunded, specify exactly which department is responsible for that. But I think it was the board's understanding that really county staff should have appealed the application and not the applicant themselves. Either way, we needed a resolve on this in order for the applicant to move forward. And trying to remove literal roadblocks in a person's approval of a development in that area And so appreciate all the efforts, I think, in your office for sometimes handling things that are tangential, not necessarily at your behest. And I think you've worked out long-term how to rectify that situation so it doesn't come before the board in this cumbersome, time-consuming, arduous, expensive process. And I appreciate your efforts in trying to streamline those things and head them off in the future so we can do them more efficiently. Appreciate that. Anything else for the board? I'll entertain a motion to approve the consent calendar, which is items 3A, B, C, and D.
So moved.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Any further discussion on those four items? Seeing none, we'll call the roll, please.
Commissioner DeYoung?
Yes.
Commissioner Morgan?
Yes.
Commissioner Hare?
Yes. Motion carries 3-0. Any other item that should properly come before the board from the board at this time? Seeing none, we'll move on to item number 5, which is matters from commissioners.
Commissioner starts today. The fair board meeting last night, and it was exciting. We have one new fair board member, Mark, and there was, I think, 3 or 4 Marks in the room. So when they said, well, who's going to take care of that? We just said Mark, and somebody would jump at it. It was real lighthearted. Serious business out there at the fair. I want to give a shout out to facility. We had a real serious problem with the roof on the arena, and it was, for some reason, it all of a sudden crystallized and was coming off of there in large sheets. And they've been working diligently. They got as much of the bad stuff off the roof, and we'll have to address that before wintertime comes. But I think they've got things pretty well cleaned up out there, and they were right there, ODAR 30 every morning, you know, to get that stuff cleaned up in preparation for the fair. There's new partitions in the pig barns that I think it's going to go well out there. I have a 50-year class reunion coming up Friday and Saturday, both in the evening, and I was really looking forward to the motorcycle stunt event, and now I don't get to see it, so I'm sad about that. But it looks like the weather's going to cooperate, going to be in the mid-90s most of the week in comparison to usually 100 to 110 that we usually witness during fair. So, and I think Thursday is free day at the fair.
Sponsored by
All Care. And in which you could use free admission to the fair, go ahead and see what you want. I don't know how, but I got cornered into driving a golf cart that day. Commissioner Morgan picked Wednesday. I think she had the inside story. I think she got the inside story and got there first. So, but I'm happy to help out. I think we all are happy to help out. It's going to be, a lot of fun. A lot of fun for Josephine County Fair. Happy to see it going so smooth out there.
With a high of like 91, 94, that's some of the most pleasant times at the fair.
Nice.
And it may or may not get up to that. I mean,
there are cooling stations also throughout the fairgrounds that are put in just in case somebody wants to just take a little rest. Some of the booths inside, I know in the commercial building, there's a large evaporative cooler that flows all the way through there. And I believe if the plug for the city of Grand Pass, I think going to have their GP Jeopardy game going again, which was really successful last year, and it was a lot of fun too. I happened to work with over there last year, so it was a real kick in the pants.
Anything else? Commissioner Morgan.
I just want to make a point to acknowledge ODF, U.S. Forest Service, our search and rescue folks, and many, many emergency responders that are responding to all the fires in our community. And we've had a little bit of a change with the lightning stopping a little bit, but just the amount of fires they've responded to, and I appreciate the communication we've gotten. I was speaking with, I can't say his last name, our forester,
Matthew Pachork.
Thank you. I spoke with him yesterday and about the Shannon Creek and just the concern of how close are we to residences and how, you know, are we having homes at risk. And, you know, we have our FireWise programs as far as making your home safe to fires and by having safe space around your houses. I do appreciate all the efforts of everybody that's responding and communicating with where we are with the fires and just encouraging people to remember to be safe and be mindful of the things that are potentially risky for the fire season.
Yes, Commissioner.
Also went to the luncheon the other day, legislative luncheon, with keynote speakers were Representative Wilson, Representative Stark, and Senator Becker. And very informative. A lot of frustration in the room from our elected officials at the state level. If you're a Democrat, you're in the majority in Salem, and if you're a Republican, you're not. And quite frustrating because all three of our representatives and Senator Bertrand are all Republicans, so they're on the short end of the stick. They're not getting a whole bunch going up there, but rest assured, they're slugging away for Southern Oregon every day. One of the things that Carl Wilson, Representative Wilson, brought forth is he said there's the worst job in Oregon this year is going to be a county commissioner in Gilstead County because of the cannabis controversy and all the rules that are going to come down for cannabis both from the state level and the county level. He said you couldn't pay him enough to be a county commissioner, and you know what? He's probably right, but I just want to let everybody know that we're going to get through this thing, you know, one way or another. It'll be March before you know it and springtime before you know it, and we're going to get through it. Maybe without some lumps and bumps, and then we're not going to be able to please everybody. I'm trying to put it into levels, into different categories as to how many folks we're trying to please, because you get one group in here, and then they tweak it a little bit, and each one of them wants all or nothing. And that's just not going to happen from this dais and this commission. It's impossible. So, you know, please keep in mind that whatever anybody's asking, if you want it all your way, that's impossible to do. So cut us some slack. And we're going to do the best we can with the information we have. So they were quite informative. They didn't have a lot of positive things to say, but it is his Oregon. And we're still going to be here. We're still a state. I don't know how we're viewed to the rest of the countryside, but I still like it here.
Well, along those lines, I was at a AOC, Association of Oregon Counties Legislative Review meeting on Monday, and their tact was also, you know, real challenging. This last session was probably the most we've seen. We had a panel of two conservatives and two Democrats on the panel, one from the Senate, one from the House, and then AOC staff did their presentation about the close to 3,000 bills that were put forward. One of the successes of our association is the fact that we were instrumental in stopping a lot of bad legislation that was proposed. So there were some Second Amendment elements that were put forward that were not enacted, and a whole host of other things that would have negatively affected counties that never saw the light of day, didn't get out of committee, and probably would have if but for the staff and the other commissioners around the state, including ours, who went up and testified and worked with committees and legislators on having that stuff put to bed before it saw the light of day. We are losing three key staffers at AOC this year. In fact, it's this week they're leaving. And so there's a massive reorganization as a co-chair of the Public Lands Committee, a member of the board and legislative committee. I'm going to be working on how, with Mike MacArthur, our executive director, on how do we reorganize and move forward and still, you know, hit above our weight, so to speak, because we are not the biggest advocates in the room. We're kind of small relative to some of the unions and some other big entities. And I echo Commissioner Morgan's points about the emergency responders on our fires. Really, we've been going about a month without an emergency services manager here at the county. We have a fairly loose IGA with Jackson County, and a cooperative agreement with emergency services management. It usually goes back and forth. However, that person's taking off Thursday and Friday, and we don't have the person who would normally fill in for them on staff here in Josephine County. It's an example of how working together works really well, but you've got to have somebody on your side of the Blackwell Hill to fill the void. Moving forward with that, I know that Medford's emergency services manager is looking to resign as well. And so there's becoming a very shallow group of people who could serve in that capacity here in Josephine County. So the fair is happening. We're going to be working on getting as many people out there to enjoy the events and such, but not to lose sight of what a county fair is really supposed to be about, getting together with people in your community in a real positive way, showcasing the highlights and positive things that have happened over time, but really take advantage of getting family and friends together out there at the fairgrounds this week. I think you'd really enjoy it, and you're probably not going to ever experience better weather. So with nothing further, board is adjourned at 10:10. Thank you all for attending.